Hello and welcome to this extra inning of The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Centre here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan US Centre's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. In April 2024, I spoke to Dr. Elizabeth Inkelson, Assistant Professor in the Department of International History at LSE and Centre Affiliate of the Phelan US Centre. Her research specializes in the histories of U.S. foreign relations, U.S.-China relations, capitalism, and labor. We spoke about Dr. Ingelson's new book, Made in China, When U.S.-China Interests Converged to Transform Global Trade, and the evolution of the U.S.-China trade relationship since the 1970s, including the role played by U.S. policymakers and capitalist interests. Well, thank you so much for joining us at the ballpark today. It's great to speak to you.
Yeah, sure. It's so great to be here, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Just to start out, could you introduce us to your research and particularly talk about how you came to study the history of the U.S.-China relationship in a historical context?
I think it's no accident that as a Australian growing up mostly in the post-Cold War era, I was interested in the relationship between the two biggest powers in the region that I was living in, right? The United States and China. I think being interested in the world and looking outwards, I wanted to make sense of the relationship between the two biggest players in the region. And in particular, when I began the project, as a PhD student, I began it in 2012. And that context was really important because it's in that period that political scientists and policymakers in the sort of early 2010s were talking about the economic interdependence between the United States and China. And they were making certain kinds of predictions about whether that economic interdependence is going to be enough to mitigate against war or some kind of conflict, that the two countries have so much at stake that they're not going to risk it for geopolitical reasons. And I really wanted to unpack those assumptions and those ideas and look at them from a historical perspective. And so that's how I began, I suppose, really wanting to understand the historical origins of this interdependence. How did we get here? How did we have China, the world's largest communist nation, converge with global capitalism? What was involved in those processes? Who was involved and why did that happen? And so, over a decade ago now, 2012, I began to sort of dig into this and dig into these ideas. And so the outcome is the book.
So your new book is Made in China, When U.S.-China Interests Converge to Transform Global Trade. Could you talk a bit about what your book is about, its main findings, and a little bit about the period that it covers? Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So as I say, the big question at the heart of the book is how did China, the world's largest communist nation, converge with global capitalism? And I'm interested in particular in thinking through the various actors and interests that enabled that convergence. And I began to sort of dig into it and found that the 1970s was such an important era and decade for understanding this convergence. It's in the 1970s that the United States and China ended what had been over 20 years of Cold War isolation. In the early stages of the Korean War in the 1950s, the United States imposed a very strict embargo on China. It was stricter than the United States had imposed, in fact, on the Soviet Union. So for over 20 years, the United States kept those Korean War embargo, that Korean War embargo in place in a way that meant that the connections, both trade, diplomatic, economic, and cultural, that those connections were entirely curtailed or largely curtailed, far more so than the Soviet Union. So in the 1970s, the United States begins to undo this. They remove the embargo. They start to sort of treat trade with China on a similar footing to that with the Soviet Union. And for the first time, a new generation of American business people begin to be allowed to trade with China, and they begin to turn to China. And so I was really interested in how do you rebuild a trade relationship after over 20 years of nothing? And what does that mean? And I was particularly struck by the fact that as these business people and as the United States began to trade with China, they were doing so in a way that was very different to how previous American and other foreign business people had traded with China in the past. For centuries, foreign business people in the United States and elsewhere had turned to China and seen this sort of fabled China market. You know, the myth of the China market has had this real sort of emotional pull on business people around the world for centuries, as I say. And at the heart of that vision had been this idea that China and its hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, that they would provide a source of customers, that they could, if you know, I think in the UK, there was this phrase that said, if the people of China, this is in the 19th century, if the people of China increased their coattails by simply 1 centimetre, then that would be enough to fulfil the needs and fuel the wishes of all the mills in England, right? The demand from Chinese customers would be enough to provide this windfall, this mythical windfall. And it's mythical because while it brought huge amount of profit to some business people, it was not the sort of unambiguous, huge influx of wealth on a national scale that had been hoped. But it was enough, the fact that some foreign business people in the United States and elsewhere, in England and elsewhere, it was enough that some of them made significant amounts of money to sort of continue that myth. But what was at the heart of that idea, right, the idea of the China market, was one of customers. And in the early 1930s, an American businessman, he was sort of this sort of very gregarious man named Karl Crow. He wrote this book that became a national bestseller. It won a National Book Award and amongst other sort of accolades. He wrote this book called 400 Million Customers. And it was reflecting on his time living and working in Shanghai and selling to China. And the message was that China was a space. It would be complex, it would be difficult, but it was a place where you could sell to its 400 million customers. And the title of Crow's book became this sort of symbol of what trade with China would look like, 400 million customers. And so it's this longer history that I was familiar with, that as I was looking at the 1970s, I began to see something very different was emerging. That American business people, yes, some of them saw this sort of much longer history, again, of the 400 million customers, but many others saw something new in China. And they began to see not just 400 million customers, but in fact, 800 million workers. They saw the capacity for China to provide cheap labor. And this vision is very, very different to how the vision of the China market had operated for such a long time before that. And so it's this transformation in the very meaning of the China market, the very meaning of US-China trade that I became interested in and that I trace in that book. And it's this transformation that was profoundly tied up with changes in US capitalism, the movement towards offshore manufacturing, the movement towards outsourcing to cheap labor, something that was still only happening in the 1970s. It certainly hadn't happened, but it was happening. And that process of change and transformation began to converge with really significant changes happening within China as well. So Chinese policymakers, pragmatists in particular, began to experiment even during the Mao era with ways of industrializing China's economy in ways that would work with the capitalist system. And so it's this convergence of interests that happened, that collide in the 1970s, that ultimately help explain how we got to the interdependence that we're so familiar with today.
Thank you. I just want to pick up on your point about convergence in terms of China's interests and the US's interests. Was it a case of China meeting the US's needs or interests, or was there kind of, was it on both sides? Were both sides converging towards something else or something new?
That's a really great question. I think it's more the latter, in the sense, or the changes that I trace are on both sides. And there was, to some degree, depending on the actors, I look at a whole range of different groups. I look at importers, retailers, large manufacturing groups within the United States. I look at pragmatists at the elite policymaking within China, as well as business people and those on the ground within China as well. There was a real understanding at the Chinese level, at that sort of the elite policymaking level, amongst a group of policymakers in the Politburo, so by shorthand, I'll call them the pragmatists. There was a real understanding amongst the pragmatists that they could use the changes that they were seeing happening, not just within China, but amongst their neighbours, right? Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, that they could begin to adopt what is known as an export-oriented development model. They could begin to integrate with these larger demands for cheap labour coming from not just the United States, but particularly so. And so there's a real overt conversation happening amongst these pragmatists in the 1970s where they do, yes, they do want to very actively encourage that. They're met with considerable and very fierce and sometimes violent opposition. And it's really, really, it's a really important part of the book, is to highlight the ways in which there was very significant opposition coming from within the Chinese Politburo itself at the elite level, but also at grassroots levels as well, just to really reinforce that there was nothing natural or inevitable about these changes, that it really did necessitate a whole range of changes happening and processes happening within China as well as the United States that did lead to the outcome that we're familiar with today. But, you know, I think the important thing to keep in mind, and I tell my students this as well, is that we live in a world, the world we live in today is the product of certain kinds of decisions and policies, and it's an outcome of the past that could have looked very different. We don't, the world we live in isn't an inevitable outcome. It's the process, an inherited process of series of different changes, and that sort of contingency, I suppose, is really, really central to the story that I tell.
Thank you so much. So you've talked a bit about this already. In the book, you look at the transformation from the perspective of Chinese and American leaders in thinking about the Chinese market as moving from 400 million customers to 800 million workers, as you've said. Can you talk a bit more about this and why this particular shift is important in understanding how global trade evolved in the late 20th century?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that was really interesting to me was the ways that American importers and retailers began to see China differently. They began to sort of tap into the experiments happening within the Politburo and therefore filtering downwards within Chinese society. And they did so in a way that was often at an economic loss. A lot of the business people I look at did not make money from their trade with China, but what they wanted was instead to cultivate relationships, to cultivate dynamics that would, in their view, hopefully yield profit down the track. Some who did make profit and those who did gain particular sort of successes in this era were those importing from China. So during this period, one of the things that really surprised me about the research for this book was that Chinese imports, so goods coming from China to the United States, were really, really important and in fact encouraged by US diplomats, by US policymakers, by the executive branch, precisely because the numbers were so low. So the trade that we're looking at in the 1970s, when you look quantitatively, it's quite minimal. And that's partly why scholars haven't looked at it before. The numbers are low. But when you look qualitatively, when you look at the meaning behind the trade itself, you can see this major transformation, as I say, that begins to emerge, the shift in the very meaning of what trade means. And so precisely because the numbers were low, US policymakers said, okay, we're going to encourage these Chinese goods to come into the United States. And they did so from a place that they were doing so from a place that wanted to use trade and therefore encourage trade as a means of assisting the diplomatic processes at play. The major sort of considerations in the time were achieving normalization, diplomatic normalization, because for most of the 1970s, the US and China had ended the embargo, But they didn't reach full diplomatic relations until the very end of the decade. It took two new leaders, right, Deng Xiaoping and President Carter. And so for that whole period of working towards normalization, trade was understood as a tool to assist that process. So it wasn't important in its own right, but rather important to the larger sort of diplomatic outcomes. And so that meant that, well, if we want to help trade or use trade to help diplomacy, let's encourage the imports from China because that's going to assist the overall trade relationship. And therefore, the importing of Chinese goods became central to the larger trade dynamic unfolding. And so US policymakers encouraged imports. Chinese policymakers certainly encouraged the sale of their own goods to the United States. And US importers, therefore, those wanting to purchase outsourced manufacturing or purchase clothing or goods from China, became central components of this process. They were important sort of agents of diplomacy, but they were also encouraged precisely because they were doing what policymakers in both countries wanted them to be doing.
Thank you. So in your book, you write extensively about the active role played by American business people such as David Rockefeller and Suzanne Reynolds in the transformation of China and its trading relationship with the world. Can you talk about why you focused on these particular individuals and how their actions made an impact?
Yeah, absolutely. So David Rockefeller was so important to the story. He was an important businessman and financier, the head of Chase Manhattan Bank, brother of Nelson. And he was really interesting in that he straddled both the political or the sort of diplomatic world as well as the economic one. Like so many of the business people I look at, the US business people I look at, saw himself as operating in a way that was assisting the larger diplomatic processes. As I say, the larger diplomatic aim of this period was to achieve normalization. And precisely because he and Susan Reynolds and a whole range of other individuals whose stories I use to illustrate these larger changes that I'm describing, what they reveal in their different ways is a series of assumptions about the relationship between trade and diplomacy that these business people, certainly many of them, did see themselves as acting as sort of agents of the US state, that they were assisting the larger political outcomes or political efforts towards normalization. And that's really important because that assumption was, as I've mentioned, also held by policymakers at the time too, who saw trade and these business people as means of assisting the larger geopolitical aims that they had. And what I wanted to do was really unpack the extent to which those assumptions were, in fact, the reality. And I wanted to not just replicate the assumptions of my the people that I was looking at in the books. I think it's very easy as a scholar when you ask yourself, well, why does this work matter? The sort of the question that you ask yourself is, so what? And any academic will tell you that it's the hardest question you ever get asked, right? So what? And it was tempting for a very long time when I was doing this research to say, so what? Well, okay, this tells us about how business people were agents of diplomacy. US business people were agents of diplomacy. And there's a very long history of the ways that business and politics have operated together in US history. And our use of sort of dollar diplomacy is a very, of the 1920s, is a very significant era in which that happened. But I soon came to see that it was far more complex than that, that precisely because of the changes in the ways that trade was operating, precisely because of this movement towards seeing not just 400 million customers, but in fact 800 million workers, that the interests of these business people I was looking at were a little more blurry, a little more complex. They weren't operating on behalf of the US state often. at all in terms of their interests. They were, I mean, they're business people, right? They're operating in terms of their bottom line. And when you have such a significant change in the way that manufacturing is operating, when you have a push towards cheap offshore labor, then the interests of these business people, I began to see, especially the importers looking to increase their purchases from China, JCPenney, for example, a big retailing company in the United States, their interests began to align very closely with the Chinese state, that they were agents of Chinese diplomacy to a much larger degree. So their interests were converging between American business people and the Chinese state. And that led to a much more complex dynamic, therefore, that I wanted to sort of tease out between the US state and policymakers, Chinese state and their policymakers, as well as US business people in between. And I found that this is a really much more blurry sort of history and a much more blurry analysis than I think certainly the actors at the time I look at considered.
Great. Thank you so much. So one argument you make throughout the book is that the industrialization and export-led growth in China came at the expense of minimum wage workers in the US. Does this imply that China's development was necessarily zero-sum? And if so, how should this impact how we reflect on the legacy of globalization?
So this is such an interesting and excellent question. I think it's really, I'm going to take it in two sort of stages. So the first is to sort of, let me unpack this argument that I make, that China's export-led growth came at the expense of minimum wage workers in the United States. Because this is an argument that I make as part of a larger project of unpacking within the book precisely where the decisions lay and the power lay in leading to this convergence between the United States and China. So in other words, really pinpointing which aspects of the United States and China, which groups within both societies enabled this convergence. And in particular, the role of importers and manufacturers was really in the United States was really crucial to that convergence. Ties into the answer I gave earlier. And what was at the heart of their decision making was this pursuit of cheap labor, no matter what, right? And we see this in a much longer history, or the history of the textile, in particular the textile industry within the United States, which is often at the forefront of a larger series of industrial changes. So if we take the textile industry as an example, within the United States, industrialization occurred within the North, within the North of the United States, and began to shift its manufacturing locations eventually from the North and the Midwest to the South, where labor was cheaper, it was more compliant because it was ununionized. And so this pursuit of non-union cheap labor, which began in the early 20th century and culminated by the mid-20th century, was an idea that fundamentally underpinned industrial policy really from the Industrial Revolution itself. It's integral to the story of industrialization is cheap labor. And so in some ways then, the unpacking the sort of the processes of change therefore means unpacking this assumption which drove manufacturers and industrialists in the mid-20th century, by the 1970s as well, to turn to China as just another source of cheap, compliant labor that they could turn to. And they were especially able to do so because of a containerization, the rise of cheap, of easier movement of goods, the rise, therefore, of supply chain manufacturing, very much only just occurring at this time. It's not the world that we live in today, right? Sounds an obvious point, but it was still very much only just evolving in the 1970s. And that set of changes was underpinned, as I say, by this much longer assumption and idea that industrialization necessitates cheap, compliant, non-unionized labor. And I think, so that idea about the importance of pursuing cheap labor as a central component of industrialization, that is central to so many of the decisions of the manufacturing industries and employers that I look at within the book. And so when we think about sort of China's growth coming at the expense of minimum wage workers, we need to disaggregate whose decisions led to that. And this is, as I say, one of the core sort of aims that I have of the book, and certainly one group that I look at and that I do place responsibility for these changes at the feet of is this group of manufacturers and leaders within the manufacturing industry who continue to operate on that assumption. Your question, though, and this is the sort of second part that I think is far more complex and far more really, really an interesting one, is the extent to which China's development was, and you say, necessarily zero sum. And I think that's a really, really excellent question. I don't know that I have a particularly useful answer. This is a question I think that development scholars grapple with, in their own research all the time. But I think what's really important to underscore is less whether or not China could have lifted its people out of poverty in a different way, and more to pinpoint the fact that the way that China has done so, or the way that the world developed the sort of 1970s to now period, that could have looked different. It could have. It was itself an era of what is often referred to now as one of neoliberal globalization. And if we unpack what that means, why was it neoliberal? Why is it a neoliberal form of globalization? It's this idea that if you create cheap goods for people, if you provide cheap goods, cheap consumption, that will have a trickle-down effect on people within a society, that the trickle-down effect is via consumption, cheap accessible goods, also tied to buying more of it, right? Fast fashion. Again, fast fashion is a concept that emerged in particular in the 1970s. So it's a neoliberal form of globalization because it centers consumption over labor. And it also de-links the two. It says, rather than saying we need to have good working conditions, we need to protect the ways that workers operate within the capitalist system, it says let's de-link those two, and we can create an even less stable and even less unionized society, but we can instead have a trickle-down effect of helping them via consumption. And we know that has not been the case. We know that through the sort of statistics on rising inequality, et cetera. So I think this particular form of capitalism, this neoliberal globalization that we have lived through, did not have to be the only way that global capitalism operated, or that China converged with global capitalism. What the outcome might have looked like if we'd had a different world, we can only speculate. But it's certainly, I think, the lesson of history more broadly is to remember that nothing is inevitable, nothing is natural, and that there are always possibilities for building a better world. We don't usually do it, but that doesn't mean that you can't try. And pinpointing where the possibilities lay, and pinpointing where the problems lay, I think are an important start.
So what insights does the newfound understanding of the origins of the US-China economic relationship that you present in the book lend us towards navigating the current US-China relationship?
So there are a couple of things that I could say about this. One of the things that I was very conscious of not doing when I was writing the book was using the word or the term President Trump. I think he is in there, but very briefly, and not in a significant way. And that's because I think the story that I tell is much bigger than him, and I was very conscious of not letting that particular change that occurred towards the end of me writing the book shape the larger story and the larger set of dynamics that I was interested in. And so I conclude the book with this sort of reflection on sort of what you know, if there is a lesson to this history and what that might be. And in my mind, the lesson of the history that I tell is not one where we need to go back to an imagined ideal of manufacturing employment. You know, the United States still manufactures stuff, you know, since the mid 20th century, from the 1940s until the present, the United States manufacturing has remained relatively stable. The thing that's changed has been its employment. So when we speak of deindustrialization, it's a deindustrialization of jobs, not of goods being produced within the United States itself. And so instead of this idea of going back to manufacturing as the sort of answer or solution to American workers, what we need, I think, is an integrated grand strategy of US foreign policy that centers the needs of American workers as they exist today within US foreign policy making. And for all the talk of the CHIPS Act as sort of assisting with geopolitics and economics, I think there is a case to be made for that. I think there is a case to be said, yes, the CHIPS Act may produce in terms of geopolitics, geopolitical outcomes, or in terms of economic outcomes, some kinds of strong sort of benefits. But what it's not going to do, and this is where it's quite misleading to hear you know, Biden or Jake Sullivan and others speak of the CHIPS Act as sort of assisting in job creation, is that it's not going to provide the jobs necessary to really support the American economy. And so the lesson, therefore, is to center the needs of American workers as they exist in the context in which we operate. Because one of the things I look at in the book itself is the ways that American workers did throughout the 1970s warn of the impact that trade with China as it operated in the particular way it was unfolding, encouraging imports, et cetera, encouraging turn to cheap labor, that would have a really detrimental effect on American workers. And that interest and that those warnings were not heeded. And so what I think is important is not to say, well, okay, we now need to sort of listen to what American workers were saying in the 1970s. Instead, what we need to do is listen to what American workers in 2024 are saying. And they're calling for, a care economy that enables childcare and health, those working in the health industries to be supported. They're calling for protection of all kinds of jobs from AI innovation. And these calls to support American workers, they're calling for support for unionization, right? These calls may seem distinct to US-China relations, but actually they're really integral to the capacity of the United States to develop a foreign policy not just towards China, but any country, because the strength of the United States in its foreign policy goals is always going to come from the strength of its own domestic economy. And so the lesson, therefore, is to heed that and to heed what American labor is saying, and not to see it as an irritant or a distraction from larger geopolitical goals.
So in your book, you set your argument in a wider historiographical debate on whether former Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping's reforms were the turning point for Chinese economic policy, or if they originated earlier in the late Mao period. Could you give our listeners just a brief introduction to this debate, why it matters, and how your book responds to it? Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the fun things that you get to do as a historian, I think as a scholar in other fields as well, but certainly in history, my area of expertise, is you get to create the debates. So yes, it's a debate, but I sort of wanted to set it up in a sort of conversational debate style as well, because I had noticed that there was an increasing number of colleagues and scholars of China who are beginning to push back against a dominant narrative. And the dominant narrative is the Deng Xiaoping, who came to power after Hua Guofeng and before him Mao. The Deng Xiaoping came to power in 1978 and introduced reform and opening to China. And it was these reforms and opening that led to the China that we know today, right? The integration of China into the capitalist economy, into the world more broadly. And it certainly was a really important moment. When Deng Xiaoping introduced these reforms, it enabled foreign direct investment. It enabled companies to set up factories of their own within China. Financial integration as well. And so this 1978 set of reforms has often loomed large in narratives of the story of how China converged with global capitalism. But there's been an emerging group, as I say, who have begun to say, well, we can see some of the changes or the origins of today's world happening before 1978. We can see experimentations happening in the 1950s and the 1960s. And this group of Chinese scholars have done a really good job of blurring this 1978 divide. But where I think the debate needs to happen, and where I sort of, as I say, I took, you know, the scholarly scholarship that I read, and I wanted to sort of position it as more of a sort of conversational space, because I'm not so sure that there is quite an easy through line to be drawn from the Mao era of the 1950s and 60s right through to the present, or that these origins are quite as consistent as some scholars suggested. And where I think the debate therefore lies is not only in blurring the 1978 divide, but also showing the ways the Mao era can be understood in sort of two different groups, that the Cultural Revolution, in my mind, was one of the most important moments in opening up possibility for China's reforms, precisely because it wrought such political and social upheaval within China. So I've joined a third group, if you will, or I've created this idea of a third group of scholars who similarly blur the 1978 divide. And there are other scholars who sort of similarly think in terms of the Cultural Revolution as really, really crucial. And I think that drawing out that distinction by saying the Cultural Revolution and afterwards as an important turning point in China's political economy is something that I really wanted to draw out. And I, as I say, I build on the ideas of many, many colleagues who are similarly doing so, but wanted to do so in a way that sort of starts a conversation and starts these questions of origins and also change and continuity. What points do we pinpoint change? At what points do we pinpoint continuity? And I would say that it's sort of the mid-1960s of the Cultural Revolution is one of those pivot points, just as 78 is as well. So, yeah, I set up the book as being a conversation between three different groups, and I position myself in the group that looks at the post-Cultural Revolution era, because I think that's really where you see the experimentation. I mean, the evidence, in my mind, bears it out. You see the experimentation happening at the elite levels within China in ways that were able to take root. So it's not just experiments, but ways of thinking about China's development in the late 1960s and into the 1970s. These experiments with how to develop China that actually were able to take hold, right? They were able to change the way that China's economy operated in ways that the experiments happening in the 1950s and 60s did not. They were not able to. They were not sustained.
Great, thank you so much. And just before we finish, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about any other projects you have coming up or anything you'd like to direct our listeners' attention to.
Yeah, I have a couple of different things I'm working on. I'm working with a research assistant, Tali Aisha, here at the US Center, the Phelan US Center at LSE. I'm working with her on a much larger project that will look at the history of US-China relations from 1949 right through to the present. And it's a project that I've been working on. It's a book. It will be a book that I've been working on around the same amount of time, a little less than I've been working on this book. I've certainly been thinking about it for quite a while, and it became a bit more sort of formalized about 4 or 5 years ago in terms of sort of the structures and the contract, et cetera. And so this book will be rethinking or providing a rethinking of the relationship from 1949 through to the present in terms of both the combination of large-scale structural changes. So I divide it up into two parts. Globalization is the second part. So perhaps unsurprisingly to your listeners, the 1970s is a major turning point in the sort of relationship and thinking about globalization as a large systemic structure by which to think through the bilateral relationship. But part one will be looking at the Cold War and thinking about, again, how this larger geopolitical structure has influenced the bilateral relationship. So those two dynamics, the bilateral and the sort of systemic structure. I'm concluding the book with a consideration of what I think is the most important third structure that we're living through, and that is the climate crisis. So the conclusion will be, I'm a historian, so there'll be limited research, limited primary sources, but I think it's an important thing to think through. And that is, how do we think about the bilateral relationship in terms of this third larger systemic change? And that is, that is the heart of the next project.
Brilliant. Well, that will be something we'll be looking out for in the near future. Elizabeth Ingelsen, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Elizabeth Ingelsen is an assistant professor in the Department of International History at LSE and center affiliate of the Phelan U.S. Center. If you'd like to hear more about Dr. Ingelsen's work, she'll be launching her new book at the LSE Phelan U.S. Center event, Made in China, When U.S. Interests Converge to Transform Global Trade, on Tuesday the 7th of May from 5 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. at LSE. Check the show notes for this episode for a link to the details to attend in person or online. And that's it for this extra inning of The Ballpark. Thanks so much to Dr. Elizabeth Ingelsen for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On Twitter and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on Facebook, we're LSE United States. This extra inning was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US. And you can tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people to find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or of the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.